You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer.
Complete Developer Podcast is supported by listeners like you. We are now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Complete Developer Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we are joined by developer, entrepreneur, and author Zachary Burt. He is here to join in the discussion about the business side of being a freelance developer or consultant. And I want to point out we are recording this episode with Zencastr, high fidelity podcasting. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Man, I've been doing a lot of project management. Like, I think 3/4 of my day is meetings and PM work and, yeah, all that fun stuff. That's pretty much all I've been doing.
I couldn't imagine. That doesn't sound like fun.
Well, like, I'm, like, redoing our SDLC right now because we're kind of doing the cowboy coding thing and that has to stop. And so, like, I'm using our project management tool and coming up with custom workflows and... Yeah, it's just a lot of clicking and not much typing, but I'm having a good time. How about you?
How about Zach?
Yeah. This week has been mostly stuff related to the business of promoting my book and transforming into content, and I have to talk about that later. But this weekend, I got into a fun challenge with the Facebook Hacker Cup. Facebook does this programming challenge every year where they call it a Hacker Cup, and it's supposedly a tournament of code, but it's really just a recruiting ploy in disguise. So I got to wrestle with their interpretation of what a top coder looks like, forcing me to remember concepts from discrete math and other fun school activities.
Oh, man. Sorry.
No, I'm with you. So that's what I've been battling.
Wow, that definitely sounds interesting. I haven't been doing anything that cool. I've been... basically building a lot of search functions lately. It's kind of some fun, complex stuff. I'm looking at several tables in the database, and I've had a little trouble getting Link to write a query joining all of the tables. So I'm doing something I absolutely hate, and that is making two database calls. I don't like it, but so far it's the only way I've gotten it to work.
Did you look at my suggestion that I sent you on that, by the way?
Yeah, and that will work once we get the objects finalized. But right now, what I'm doing is I have an object that contains a list of objects, and each one of those in the list has an object in it, and I'm trying to search the grandparent object by a parameter on the grandchild object.
And so this is the point where Beege learns the magic of select N plus one.
Yeah, this is just sort of the finishing touches that we're putting on this app. It's we're supposed to release it on the 31st of the month.
This makes me so grateful for Ruby on Rails. Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah.
So I'm getting the last pieces of the API out, and then I get to jump back over to working on the Angular side of it. On a happier note, I am enjoying some more Andy Gator. Because Will found the big bottles.
So. Yeah, I saw those when I was going to get my beer, and I bought the rest of them they had. Because I know that's, you know, kind of your thing, and they're a little bit hard to find around here. So,
yeah, I am thoroughly enjoying it. And Zach, if you don't know, we have a beer when we record, and Andy Gator is made down in Louisiana, and I used to live down there, and it is one of my favorite beers. It's just hard to find in Tennessee. But with all that said, let's go ahead and roll the music. This week for IoTs, I have another in our list of Raspberry Pi Zero projects. Still really enjoying them. This is Build Your Own Drone. It's called the Pi Zero Drone. It's controlled by a Raspberry Pi Zero, and you can build it for around $200. This is a smart drone using a Debian-based file system and DroneCode's APM flight stack. It uses the PXF Mini autopilot board And it's kind of a fun project. The tutorial says it takes about 30 minutes to put together, and I'll have a list of the hardware and software required in the show notes. So, Will, who's talking to us this week?
I think we got this comment through email. This is one that you sent in. It's from Srikant Mahapatra. Mm-hmm. Hoping I'm not butchering the name too bad. It says, hello, BJ and Will. I just wanted to say thanks for producing a high-quality podcast, not just on programming and software development, but also on how to live a better life as a developer. I've been listening to your podcast for some months now, and it has gradually become my favorite programming-based podcast, and I listen to quite a few of them. I especially loved your educational episodes on numbers, optimizing algorithm efficiency, and principles of object-oriented programming. I wish you could do more of such episodes that have educational value. Some topics that I can suggest are data structures, debugging and testing, including the various types of testing such as unit testing, stress testing, etc., computer organization and architecture, and how to program simulations. In addition, Will has a lot of experience in the industry, so I'd also love to see him talk about programming languages in general, their evolution over the decades, the influence of C on modern languages, etc. Cheers and keep them coming.
Well, thanks, Srikant. We've added those suggestions to our backlog, and send us an email or PM with your address because we've got some complete developer swag just for you. And guys, if you'd like your very own complete developer swag, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or any of our social media. We post all of our episodes to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+, and we're also on Path and Tumblr. I also want to point out that our friend Bethany Adams has released her second book, and so to celebrate, we're running another contest where we'll be giving away an autographed copy of her book. It'll be the winner's choice, and we'll be announcing the winner the first episode in May. To enter, just leave us a review in iTunes. We love seeing those 5 stars. To get started, Zach Burt has been programming for about 20 years and consulting for 10. And he truly loves programming. Over the years, he has worked for large companies and startups in both individual contributor and leadership roles. He is passionate about open source, both in submitting pull requests and launching open source projects. His first book is called Code for Cash and teaches developers about breaking into the world of freelance consulting. It's available at www.breakingintoconsulting.com. He lives in Manhattan, where he enjoys playing basketball and meeting new and diverse people. He encourages you to ping him if you'd like to meet. Zach, as a fellow autodidact, I kind of looked you up a little bit. I'm curious, what attracted you to coding in the first place?
Well, this may be the nerdiest thing ever, but I was in a contest, a school contest, memorizing Pi. And I was caught up in the competition, and school principal pulled me aside and said, now, if you're interested, I co-authored a book on calculating Pi using computers. And he had this textbook with a basic program. And I was so excited, and I brought it home with me, and I got the computer up and running, and got it working in QBasic, and I was hooked. Ever since then, I've really been pulled to programming through wanting to make things. There's something that I want to build, like an app or a hack or something. And then I learn how to do that, just hacking my way through. And then I get the education to fill in the blanks later. So then I get the O'Reilly book or the Pact Publishing book or whatever, and then I fill in the blanks. But I'm always motivated. It's like, it's more of a pull than a push. So I let my passion for building things be my guide.
That's awesome. And I would be remiss as an older brother if I did not ask, how far did you get with Pi?
3.14159265335897932384626432383279508419715125829745192302 7164628629986802348255341711. I don't know. So
the reason I ask, my baby sister is a math teacher, and she listens to the show, and she, for Pi Day, I think it was last year, they had a contest at her school. Yeah, when she listens to this episode, she's going to ask me, she's like, well, why didn't you ask him how far he got?
So, awesome.
So guys, this outline was written after I read Zach's book. And we're going to kind of hit some highlights from the book, but there's way too many topics to cover in just one podcast. And at the end of the episode, we're going to tell you guys about the special deal that Zach is giving to our listeners and how you too can get a copy of Code for Cash. To start off, let's talk about freelancing versus consulting and kind of what the differences are there.
Absolutely. So in my experience, freelancing is mostly when you're performing a discrete task. Like, for example, let's say you came to me and said, Zach, I need you to write some code that changes the background of my webpage to dark when it's nighttime and lightens the background when it's daytime. And you said, you know, write it in this language and get it to me in this time frame and we're done and then I'll pay you. Well, that's more of a freelance job. But when it comes to consulting, you generally take more ownership for what you're delivering to the client. You try to frame your solution not in terms of code, but in terms of business value or organizational value. And that means either you're reducing costs, and that includes time, you're making them more efficient, or you're making them money, you're automating something or fixing something that's broken, all in service of a bigger mission of producing business value. And generally, when you're doing consulting, you can get away with charging more because you can capture value and it's more of a business-to-business type of contract, like a corp-to-corp, rather than them just bringing you on as a contractor for a specific gig, if that's clear.
Yeah, that does make good sense. So who would you say that consulting compared to freelancing is for, really? Like expert developers, novice developers, where would you say that someone could get into consulting?
Well, I think you can get into consulting once you're confident of the business value of your solution. So it really doesn't require you to be an expert programmer in order to start consulting. To be completely straightforward, the first freelance consulting job that I ever took on, I was in high school, and I was in computer science class, and instead of paying attention, I was on a web forum called Something Awful.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that.
Yeah, the essay forums. It was a forum goon, and there was a software-hardware forum, and there was a guy who was running a web hosting company, and back in the day, web hosting companies were like the big internet business, because everybody wanted a website, but the solutions that exist today weren't really so prevalent, so it was extremely challenging to get online. Anyway, this guy who was posing as like a successful businessman in his 40s, I found out he was also a high school student later on, had completely screwed up his server, and Apache wouldn't start. So he posted on the forum, I said, I can help you. I sent him my AIM screen name, and then I just tried solutions like mad. I just threw thing after thing against the wall to see what stuck. And this was back when documentation for Apache wasn't so great. I'm not sure it's so great now. No offense, you know, all due respect to the Apache project and the maintainers, but it was definitely challenging. But eventually I got it working, and he said, what's your PayPal? And I gave him my PayPal. I didn't even expect to be paid. I just wanted to do some good. And then he tossed me some money. He tossed me a few $100, and that was the first consulting job I ever did. And I saved his business. I prevented his business from having a reputation as a web host that didn't host. So he was super grateful, and that all worked out. And thanks to Mike Dolgan of Netlux for being my first client back in the day.
See, you were using AIM to get business in high school, whereas I was using it to meet girls in high school.
Yeah, that wasn't happening for me. You know what?
Yeah.
No, just not whatsoever. But I later ended up leveraging MySpace to meet girls in high school. MySpace was invented the senior year in high school, and that was like a miracle for me.
Yeah, I was using AOL Instant Messenger to reboot servers because there was a bug. Like you could give it you could send HTML through that, and if you had a font name that was over 255 characters, it would cause the box to bounce because there was a Windows issue.
AIM
and you
punch.
Could use it, and so you would like give your each server a different AIM address, and you could reboot them remotely.
Oh, that's awesome! That's a great hack.
Yeah, not really. Like looking back on it, you're like, I'm almost ashamed I survived that. You know?
It's kind of... But, you know, AIM was one of the big things that ignited my love of programming. I wanted to make an AIM bot, and I found the NetAIM library. It was a Perl library by Arya Goldsmith, and he's gone on to do some great things in the tech world, just an amazing coder.
So what are some of the challenges and benefits of, I guess, both freelancing and consulting, and is...
Yeah.
I guess what I'm getting at is, like, is one better for someone than the other?
Well, I'd like to take the time to just clarify that in the real world, freelancing, consulting is maybe kind of sort of like the difference between coder and developer and software engineer, if you will.
Yeah.
If you really want to make a fine point of it, you could. But in practice, many people use the terms interchangeably. So... when it comes to talking about some of the challenges with this lifestyle, let me start. One is that since you're not employed by a company with a reputation, well, not necessarily. I mean, you can consult for a big company, but you have to deal with the fact that since you're not a W-2 employee, your paychecks may be unreliable. Companies pay their employees every 2 weeks, but when it comes to paying a consultant's invoice, suddenly you have to deal with the fact that your invoice may not get paid for 30 days, 60 days, or 90 days.
Or may not ever get paid.
And that's a challenge in of itself, exactly. In the book, I talk about some techniques for dealing with it. And let me tell you, it's really emotionally upsetting when that happens. The first time it happens to you, you're like, it's like a betrayal. Just the number one advice that I have for you, if that happens, by the way, is just... take a moment and meditate and breathe and don't send any emails, don't make any threats. Realize that it's business, and sadly, oftentimes people do and only do what they can get away with. So,
as Will can say about dealing with the bus schedule here, when you do send those emails, write them for discovery.
Yeah, that's something I have learned is like you don't write an email. You know, when it's to that level, you don't write it necessarily to get a reaction out of the person. It's to get a reaction out of their lawyer when they're in discovery to go, hey, you need to settle.
That's well said. That's wise. Absolutely. Because when it comes to dealing with unpaid invoices, it can often be pragmatic to get a lawyer involved. I'm not saying that you should take them to court. It rarely makes sense to go to court unless you're dealing with 50K, 100K plus. But getting a lawyer involved can make the world of a difference between an invoice that goes unpaid and an invoice that gets paid promptly. Because then your lawyer knows all the right language and he knows how to say it in a way that won't backfire for you. I had this client who stiffed me on a $34,000 invoice. And they... it was the classic, the check is in the mail line, except for, oh, I initiated the wire transfer, must not have processed yet. And then his business partner, then told me, oh, there was no wire transfer. So I found out that they were lying. Anyway, I was upset, and I wrote this code using Node.js that optimized their marketing. So they had an app that, I won't go into details, I'm not going to name names, but basically, it sent email reminders to people who hadn't logged into the app to log back into the app. And it optimized all of their key performance indicators by creating some email automation, some app notification service notifications, and so forth. And I wrote this on a Node.js, and I spun up my own box to produce it. And then they didn't pay me. I took it to my lawyer, and my lawyer said, hey, look, there's a clause in your contract that talks about background technology, and it talks about how you may use technology that you've written before that you can leverage to improve their business, and when they pay you, they get a perpetual license to this background technology, royalty-free, but they don't get licensed to it until they pay you. So he told me, Zach, you can just pull this code down, they're going to lose out on a ton of revenue, because they haven't paid you, and they have no recourse because it's your code. And I did that, and a few days later, I had $17,000 in my hands. We worked out this thing where they paid me half up front, and they wanted some additional feature work done in order to get the other half, but I decided just to walk away instead of dealing with the dishonest gentleman. So, lawyers. Yeah, I mean, you know, I love a lawyer joke as much as anybody, but... when they're good, when they're on your side, you know, it can be awesome.
So since we're talking about getting paid, let's talk about setting a rate.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because this was something that I did, you know, like I did contracting for about 3 years, did do some consulting in there, but, you know, all told, most of it was, you know, contracting through a recruiter, and my rate was drastically too low. And it was okay, like, if the work was steady, but, like, if the work ever dropped off or there was a problem with payment, it was, you know, like, it hit the savings account. And so this is something I think is going to be pretty useful for a lot of our listeners out there that are kind of in the same boat, even if they're just doing contracting.
So the key thing to remember when setting a rate is the concept of BATNA, or Best Alternative to No Agreement. So if, let's say that instead of consulting, you could go get a job as a salaried software developer. Well, then that's your best alternative to no agreement. So in order to calculate your hourly rate based on your salary, you take your annual salary and then you divide it by 2,000. So, for example, if you're making $50,000 a year in salary, you divide it by 2,000 and you charge $25 an hour. Because that's comparable, because otherwise you would just go take the salary job because it's more stable, it's less risk, they're going to pay you on time, they'll probably toss you some benefits. And that's sort of how you get a foundation for where to anchor your rate. Now, when it comes time to increasing your rate, you should charge as much as you can get away with. Whatever number you're thinking, try just doubling it and throwing it out there. If clients are accepting your rate right away without any hesitation, it's probably too low. So you can just try raising your rate. It's okay. If you double your rate and then you have to apply for two freelance gigs instead of one, well, you're probably coming out ahead anyway because you're preserving your time. And it's really just key in the business of consulting to always be prospecting. So always do outreach, find new clients. When you don't have a full workload, try to spend 4 hours a day finding new clients. When you do have a full workload, spend time finding new clients anyway, because it's in your best interest. And the more options you have, the more you can charge. And honestly, when you're charging a high hourly rate, clients are often happier to pay you because they treat you with a little bit more respect than someone who's just charging a little bit of money. They see you as more of a peer.
Yeah, that matches my experience as well, because I've worked with clients. I did a fixed bid that was like a $1,000 job, and I mean, it just kept on, you know, they were slow to pay. They kept on adding stuff to it. It was, you know, they wouldn't get back with me. And, you know, I ended up, I think I spent like 60 or 70 hours getting that $1,000. And that was pretty early on. So that was a lesson for me, obviously. Yeah, you really get a higher quality of client the more you charge. It's the best filter you have, really, other than the actual direct interview or discussion with them.
Will, you mentioned something there that I wanted to ask both of you about, because the very first client I had freelancing consulting when I was still apprenticing with you was a per project. So I got a flat rate for the project. And so I was wanting to ask both of you guys, what do you think? And this is something I think a lot of people are curious about. We've talked about like the concept of value-based pricing and things like that. But is it better to charge an hourly rate, or would you rather charge a, I will build this for you for this amount of money?
I would almost always go with the hourly myself, or not necessarily hourly, but like I wouldn't go with a fixed bid and a not fixed spec, if that makes sense.
If you're going to go fixed, stay fixed across the board.
Yeah, because I mean, like, there's always an opportunity for renegotiation if, you know, something else comes up, but you have to be really, really careful, or at least I do, with fixed bid, because when you've already sunk some work into something, I have a tendency to go, oh, well, I don't want to alienate this client, even though they've thrown a curveball and it's going to cost a bunch of extra time. So, like, from my personal psychology perspective, I've not seen it work out very well for me.
Zach, what's your opinion on that?
That matches exactly with my experience, Will. And in fact, let me make a recommendation for everyone. Have a fixed spec even when you're charging hourly.
Yes.
And the reason that this is good is because it helps set expectations for the client, and it forces them to think through what you're going to build. And it actually helps with the sales process too, because it forces them to visualize the finished product, and then they form an attachment to it, and then they have loss aversion and they don't want to lose it. So they're more likely to pull the trigger on the deal, so to speak, if they have a fixed spec Not to mention that it'll make you code faster. And I always recommend slashing features wherever you can. I'm a huge advocate of agile development and getting to market and getting revenue positive as soon as possible and validating your idea. I don't want to go on a tangent here, but I've been in this software startup ecosystem for too many years now where I've seen people spend years on developing a product that they are scared to show to the customer because they want to be perfectionists. They want to get everything right, and it turns out the customer never wanted it in the first place. And then as a developer, I shouldn't, but I feel guilty because I want to see my clients succeed. I genuinely want them to thrive. I want them to be happy. And you know, I want them to be successful. I mean, it's in my best interest because the more successful they are, the more referrals they're going to throw my way, the happier they're going to be. They're going to send me more business. So I definitely recommend nailing down a spec and charging hourly when you can. In terms of charging a fixed rate, you can do that, but gosh, you got to be really good at estimating. It takes a lot of experience to be able to estimate properly. When I first started, my rule of thumb was figure out however long it's going to take me, okay, then double it again. So the rule of four. So however long I thought it was going to take me, multiply it by four, and that's the estimate I would give to the client. And that helped me under-promise and over-deliver. And managing clients' emotions through good communication and managing expectations is so important in consulting. And it's ultimately a lot more important than the quality of your code. At the end of the day, your client is going to have no idea about the quality of your code. And as long as it runs and gets the job done and delivers the business value that the client is seeking, then client's going to be really happy. You know, clients will get turned off and offended if you spend too much time talking about jargon, if you spend time putting the CSS attributes in alphabetical order, like what have you. It's just immaterial to them. And if you can help them understand that you're one of the honest developers, it's kind of like mechanics. You know, if you don't know anything about cars and you go to a mechanic, you have no idea whether the mechanic is going to rip you off or not. There's a lot of fear there. And if you can soothe your client's emotions and help them really understand what's going on and empathize with that, they're going to be so much more comfortable. You know, a lot of them have biases against developers. Developers think they're so smart and it's like a Mars-Venus type of thing almost. But if you can empathize with the client and understand the client wants the business value rather than the awesome, elegant coding solution, both of you are going to come out ahead. That's not to say that you should code bad, because your client may have an independent auditor go through your code and call you out. But you have to explain to the client ahead of time that you're making trade-offs and you're sacrificing, you know, certain things, you know, in order to promote their business interests.
I can completely agree with that.
And if the client isn't happy with the end result, they're going to blame you. They're going to point the finger at you, and there's nothing you can do about it, really, except to take responsibility. But the flip side of that is when the buck stops with you, you get to charge more. So it's a double-edged sword.
Well, speaking of clients, let's kind of get into how to find clients as a consultant. So, like, where do you look for them?
Will, did you want to go first? I'm happy to riff here, but I heard you.
The thing with the clients that I had is they seem to find me a whole lot more than I found them. And I don't know why that was. I guess I have a fairly decent network, and maybe that's part of it. You know, I had some friends that, you know, tended to bump into people. And so it wasn't so much like me going out hunting as it was putting out bait, I guess is a better way to put it.
Let's see, I got my first clients through my apprenticeship with you.
Yeah. So. And I mean, and those were phone calls I got while I was going down the road, not thinking about software development at all. So, you know, it's just people that had kept me in mind. So I don't really, I mean, I think now with the podcast, I probably would do things differently because I think I'm a little bit more aware of how marketing impacts things. But, you know, previously I just sort of kind of floated along. I was basically, I was a software development equivalent of Plankton. So do you have like an actual method or?
Oh yeah. I have, in the book, I break down, in depth 15 different ways to find clients proactively. And, I'm going to run through some of them right here, right now. If you want to learn about them in depth and have them all for your reference whenever you're stuck and want some more business, definitely get a copy of the book. But here we go. Okay. Let's start with Craigslist. Craigslist is such a, it's like a dungeon in an RPG where you can either find rare gems or horrible monsters. It's like the best of humanity and the worst of humanity in one place.
Those horrible monsters tend to be in the personal ads, by the way.
Enough about your dating life, man.
So, you have to be careful, but you can find great clients through Craigslist. The computer gigs section is good. Post a resume on Craigslist, but in the body of your resume, mention that you're a consultant and not available for full time. But definitely, there was a term in SEO, search engine optimization, years back called keyword stuffing. That's when you would put a bunch of different keywords on your webpage. So version 1.0 search engines like AltaVista and Yahoo and early Google would take a look and use the keywords that were actually in your text to find, to point people to your webpage. And now that's called keyword stuffing and it's frowned upon, but on Craigslist, it's totally okay, because people on Craigslist are searching for talent to build them what they want to have built. So, for example, if they're looking for an iPhone app, you know, they'll search iPhone developer, iPhone coder, iPhone programmer. So in your ad, you want to put all the variations. You want to mention iPhone, iOS, iSpace phone, dev, developer, coder, programmer, software engineer, etc. You can put all those at the bottom of your post, but make sure the title of your post has a headline that speaks to your clients as the, you know, like in their own voice. So for example, let's say I wanted, you know, I'm a client, I have an idea for an iPhone app that'll change the world and be the next Uber. Uber for cats. I don't know, some genius idea. And, you know, then, you know, and I might click on an ad that says, do you need a genius programmer to build your next app, but still talk to you like a human? And then in the body of your ad, you might say, hi, my name's Speech. I've been writing apps for this long. Here are some links to my work. I love writing apps. I'm great at it. I can make sure your app is a success. I can handhold you through to launching it so you don't have to deal with all the weird parts like dealing with App Store and how confusing it can be and signing build, etc. I'll take care of all of that for you. You just tell me what you need and I'll make sure we get it done. You know, and that's the kind of ad that people really respond to. So Craigslist is just awesome if you work it right. So there's Craigslist gigs, Craigslist services, and Craigslist resumes where you can find work. The next avenue I'll talk about is meetups. So there are three main ways to find work through meetups. One is going to meetups and just networking with people. If you meet people and, you know, at meetups, that's a great way to proactively get the word out about you in the local developer community so that when people need a consultant for something, they think of you. Make sure you follow up with them after you meet them at the meetup. Add them on LinkedIn. By the way, this is an aside, if you don't have the fact that you're available for consulting on your LinkedIn, add it to your LinkedIn. You know, if your day-to-day is a software developer at Megacorp, that's cool, but how does having that as your LinkedIn headline help you? I don't think it does. But if you change your LinkedIn headline to blah, 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 consultant, every time you visit someone's profile on LinkedIn, they're going to see in their profile views, blah, 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 consultant. And that's a great way to passively promote yourself and your availability.
I was gonna say also, LinkedIn has they have a service basically for putting consultants and businesses that are looking for them together. I know I got a couple of clients through that.
Awesome. I'll have to follow, you know, I didn't know about that one. I'll have to follow up with you about that after the show, because I want to learn more about that, definitely. So, let's see. You can give talks at meetups. If you have an idea for a talk, that's a great way to brand yourself as an authority. And all it takes to give a talk at a meetup, you don't have to, there's no rule that you have to be invited to speak in order to give a talk. For a lot of junior developers, there's this, like, perception that there are these gods in the programming community who are just beyond reproach and people invite them to give talks because they're somehow better. No, you just have to reach out and be okay with rejection. Consulting is sales, and sales is sometimes, oftentimes, a lot of the time, dealing with rejection. And you just have to not take it personally, realize it's a numbers game. You get what you give. So if you give and contribute karma to the community, give talks at meetups, that's a great way to get yourself some consulting business. And also, if you subscribe to a meetup, make sure you join the mailing list. And when you join the mailing list, set your emails to get your reply notifications instantly rather than at the end of the day or at the end of the week. Because that way, a lot of times when people are looking for help with specific technology, they'll send out a request through a mailing list and the early bird gets the worm. So whoever's quick to jump on the opportunity will often wind up with it. So those are three ways to get business through Meetup. Let's talk about some more. Ex-coworkers. So
yeah, and that was where mine a lot of my network was, is that it was just ex-coworkers, you know, and I kind of made them aware that I was, you know, looking for work or that I would be, and it just, you know, then the work started coming in. So I guess it was kind of a pretty passive way to do it. So I guess you got a structure for that, or?
Well, yeah, sure. Make a list of all the ex-coworkers at your old jobs who you actually liked, and add to the list anyone who you knew your reputation for being good, and then go through and add all those people on LinkedIn, and you know, make sure your headline is updated to say blah 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 consultant, and that's just a great way to passively get the word out about you. And then when you interact, when you like a status, you know, word travels. We live in a small community. I mean, there's the 6 degrees of separation. It's a tightly knit global world, and it's word will spread if you just make some efforts to put the word out there. Ex-coworkers are a great channel. So are ex-clients and ex-employers. You can call them up and say, hey, is there any work I can do for you as a consultant? If there was an employer you really liked working for, big companies, small companies, medium companies, they hire employees. They also will hire consultants oftentimes. The benefits to them is they don't have to pay employment taxes. They don't have to pay for health care. You know, require you, if you're a consultant, you're considered to be more independent and require less management. There's less overhead. You're more responsible for delivering. Definitely ask ex-clients for referrals. If a client liked you, they will put the word out. Now, you know, basically any sort of chamber of commerce is good. For example, when I was at university, I went to my university's alumni center and said, you know, do you know any alumni who might be interested in having a Facebook app built for them? That ended up being a great referral channel for me. Just put the word out. If you give me a second, I'm going to pull up the book right here. I have it in PDF format on my computer. And by the way, if you buy the book direct from me, you get it in PDF, EPUB, and Mobi for your Kindle, e-reader, or desktop. Okay, so some more channels. Hacker News. News.ycombinator.com. At the first of the month, every month, there's a thread where people say, are you a freelancer or are you looking for a freelancer? Post in this thread. And that happens on the first business day of every month. Sometimes it'll happen on a Saturday, so if it's not posted and on the first of the month, check the next day, but it'll be at the top of the page. And you'll find companies that are looking to hire a freelancer, oftentimes remotely, and you can post an ad for yourself. And when someone's looking for a contractor, they'll just reach out to all the ads they like. So definitely try to contribute on social media. I met one of my current most lucrative clients. We met on Reddit. I was in the Ruby on Rails subreddit, and I was just posting, contributing value. And then someone replied to me and said, by the way, I'm looking to hire a consultant. I have too much work and I'm swamped. And I just PM'd him and we got to it. And we made thousands of dollars together before we even met up in person. And that guy ended up being my co-author on this book, Code for Cash. He's also been a consultant for many years. And so you get the benefit of both of our experience. Continuing, blogging is a great channel. If you blog about a technical topic, you build yourself up as an authority. Make sure at the bottom of every blog post, in your signature, your author bio, you mention that you're a consultant, that you're available, and make it easy for people to contact you. Building an open source project is a great way to get traction in your consulting business. If you build an open source project, people will just email you out of the blue and ask that you help them. Gun.io, www.gun.io, is an application-only freelancer community. It's a great way to find lucrative contracts. They handle all of the QA and project management and billing for you, so your capacity to make money isn't sky high, but they're looking for subcontractors who do all of the coding for their jobs. So if you apply, you can hang out in their Slack channel, and you'll get a ping whenever there's a gig that matches your preferences.
Wow, that looks really cool. I'm going to keep that one for sure.
What about networking at conferences? And the reason I ask this is because I'm going to be going up to New York in April, on April 21st and 22nd, because our friends over at Code Newbie are putting on their first conference called Codeland. And again, that'll be in New York on April 21st and 22nd. And if you guys want to meet me and do some networking, you guys can come out to the conference. Check it out at codelandconf.com. Back to it. What about networking at conferences? Is that a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely. Network with people. A networking tip that I can share is have way more business cards ready than you think you'll need, because you will give them out like hotcakes. And one rule about business cards that I really want to stress is don't be the one guy giving out your business card, or don't be the one gal giving out your business card. If everyone's giving out their business card, that's great, but just don't be the odd one out. If everyone in the room is networking by adding each other on LinkedIn using their phones, just go with the flow. There's no need to like set yourself apart from the crowd by being retro with a business card, but have them anyway and have more than you think you're going to need.
That makes good sense, because there's a time to set yourself apart from the crowd and there's a time not to. What you're saying is that is not the time to set yourself apart.
Probably not.
Yeah, the way you set yourself apart in that situation is actually have something that they remember about you when you know from the conversation you had with them, and the card is just the delivery mechanism of your information. So you don't, you know, you kind of want that to be standard the same way they got everybody else's. That way they don't lose it.
We have a lot of listeners that are self-taught or maybe don't have a degree. And one question that we've been asked several times by a lot of different people is, how do you sell your skills if you don't have a degree to back them up?
The answer is work samples. You want to tell clients that you can solve their problem because you've done it already. Clients love hearing, I've solved this problem 10 times before. Yours is just the same. Because of that, I know exactly how long it's going to take. There are going to be no surprises. And I know all the secrets and all the insiders related to this problem because I've been there, I've done that. If you have that sort of credibility, you do not need a degree. You do not need any pedigree or education whatsoever. It's all about having experience. And when it comes to consulting and freelancing, if you can tell the client, I've solved this exact problem before and I'm an expert at it, they love to hear that. They don't want to hear, I'm a fancy programmer with an MIT degree who knows 11 programming languages and blah, 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 because they don't know what that means. And they have no way to know whether that's true. So I found it is almost universally the case in consulting that clients don't care about your education at all, don't even mention it, unless you happen to say, you know, go to the same school or something, or like the same sports team or from the school or something like that. Just talk about your experience solving their exact problem. They love hearing that.
What about objections? When you're trying to find clients?
Yeah. So there are a few standard objections in the sales process. The client will say, it won't work. And the way you address the it won't work objection is by saying, I've done this before. I know it works. Here are some references. Here are some ways that you can see for yourself that I've done it before. Look at these apps. Look at this website. Look at this, show the closest tech person you know this code sample and come back to me and tell me that this isn't awesome. There's also, it won't work for me. That's another objection. It won't work for me because I'm a unique and beautiful snowflake and my situation is different because of this. Well, you know, just tell them why it'll work for you. Show them a reference point. Let them know that, yes, it will work for them. Another objection is it costs too much. And the way you address the it costs too much objection is by talking in terms of business value. So I might charge 10 times more than a newbie programmer who, you know, has only 1 month of coding experience, but I'm going to be way more than 10 times faster than he or she is, and I'm going to be way more experienced. So not only am I going to be faster, but I'm going to solve things in a better way because I've done it before. So I talk about the total cost of ownership for them. I talk about the maintenance costs, and I talk about the business value. And there's a saying that goes, you don't know how expensive it is to hire a professional unless you've hired an amateur. The saying isn't coming to the top of my head, but look up that saying, get the language right, and clients will understand what you're talking about. I mean, it's like one of those, prevention is worth a pound of cure. You know, just let them know that you're going to deliver value and that you're a professional and you charge more because your time is valuable and because your experience. It's like the whole, like, you know, knowing an electrician or comes to fix a problem in the wiring and he just taps the wall with a hammer and he charges the client $1,000. The client says, what? Why are you charging me $1,000 for it took you 5 minutes? Well, the tap cost you $5, but the knowing where to tap cost you $995.
Yep.
So it's all about the value that you're delivering to the client and value-based pricing. And when you get the client to go through the emotions of understanding the value that you're delivering to them, getting them attached to the outcome, letting them know that if they hire you, it will definitely work. So there's not any risk in the pricing. When there's something risky and a project might fail, you want to pay less because you have to account for the risk. But when it's de-risked and you convince the client that you've done it before and you'll be able to do it and you're a reliable, incredible person, then, you know, absolutely you can get away with charging super high amounts of money.
Moving on, now that we have found our clients, we've overcome their objections, what goes into creating a contract with a new client?
As one Hollywood executive famously said, an oral contract isn't worth the paper that it's written on. So make sure you have something in writing. Skype is fine as long as the messages have passed the editing period. Email is fine. A written agreement is a written agreement. Just because it wasn't printed in a fancy font and saying heretofore and, you know, the undersigned blah, blah, blah. In many states, a written agreement is still a valid and binding contract. And also, remember that your relationship is more important than your contract unless you're dealing with big, big sums of money. So if the client's happy, the relationship's good, they're probably going to honor the agreement. So one thing I'll really want to share here, if you get the book, a lawyer who actually happens to be my father wrote the section on contracts. He's a professional. He handles small business deals. He works for tech companies all the time as an in-house counsel or an outside counsel. He understands the world of contracting, and he wrote a chapter specifically on the concepts a developer needs to know for their contract. In reviews of the book, the big feedback that we've been getting from some of the top developers who we sent copies of the book to was that the contract stuff is extremely well explained. Legal jargon scares most people. They think you need a fancy law degree and a law school education to understand legalese. It's often an intimidation technique for people. The book makes it really crystal clear. It's written by a lawyer with years of experience. He'll do a much better job explaining it himself than I will. So I recommend reading the book, but I want to share some important ideas here. One, just have a contract, because you really want a written record that you can refer back to. And two, in the contract, put a retainer. So make sure the client pays you a check up front, and if you're billing hourly, bill against the retainer. So that way, you're getting paid, and you have the money, but you don't charge the client. You charge against the retainer. So you take the money from the retainer, and that avoids all sorts of disputes. And asking for a retainer up front is a common practice in professionals. Most lawyers won't work without a retainer. So if you ask for a retainer up front, not only does it avoid the risk of you getting screwed out of getting paid, but it also signals to the client that you're a high-quality professional who takes the work seriously. And I recommend asking for a retainer. The next point that I really want to share here about contracts is non-disclosure agreements. Signing a non-disclosure agreement is totally cool. It makes sense. If you're working on a client's project, you should sign one. Here's the thing. Don't sign an NDA unless it's part of your billing agreement. In other words, if they ask you to sign an NDA, say, sure, I'm happy to include an NDA as part of our billing agreement. That way, they don't, you know, try some weird cowboy move where they, and someone's pulled this on me before, they have you sign an NDA, they tell you about the idea, they don't hire you, years go by, they come out of the blue and they try to harass you because you stole their idea, allegedly, even if you haven't done anything. It's weird. People are desperate in business. They try crazy maneuvers. Be very careful. I absolutely recommend signing an NDA to protect your client's confidentiality. You should value confidentiality. It's an important part of being a professional consultant. But you got to know, don't sign that NDA unless it's part of the billing agreement. Unless it's part of your larger contract, that's the time to sign an NDA. And that's a great closing technique, too. Because if they ask you to sign an NDA, you say, you know, I'd be happy to sign an NDA. This one is included in my contract. Here you go. I filled it out for you. All we need is your signature.
I like that.
Because I've also seen NDAs get abused a ton. I mean, I'm kind of surprised that there hasn't been, you know, some sort of major legal action, you know, to fix the way NDAs actually get used, particularly in certain states. It's a little bit over the top. It's past the point of, you know, privacy in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and I want to say I was on what you said about the contract section. It's interesting because I hadn't originally planned on including that in the outline when we first talked, but then after reading the book, I thought this section, we need to talk about this because this is really good stuff. So hearing that it was written by a lawyer makes a lot of sense.
I'm going to pass your praise and feedback on to him. I'm sure he'll be glad to hear it. Oh, one thing I want to share about time tracking is that when you're a consultant, you can now start billing in increments. That means if you're working for 14 minutes, you can round that up to 15 minutes. I recommend billing in quarter hour increments. That way, if a client bugs you, you know, and asks, you know, for 5 minutes of your time, charge them for 15 minutes. That's totally normal, professional, and acceptable in the professional consulting world. You know, after all, they did interrupt you, and they prevented you from getting into that sweet state of flow that every programmer knows and loves to get into in coding. So definitely round up to quarter hour increments and specify that in your billing agreement.
I agree with that. As a consultant, how do you set and send invoices to clients?
The simplest thing you need is just a written record. So an email that just says invoice in the subject, and then give it an invoice number. Just remember, number all your invoices. Invoice one, invoice two. Then put the hours worked, the amount charged, the terms of payment, whether, for example, whether it's billed against retainer, whether they should pay you for a wire transfer, et cetera, and reinforce the value. And when I talk about reinforce the value, talk about the business value that you delivered. That will prevent buyer's remorse, where clients say, they hem and haw, and they say, well, I don't really want to pay this invoice. How can I get away with screwing over this consultant? You want to reinforce the value by explaining what you did for them. You know, and don't inflate your hours, because that's a slippery slope, breeds hostility. Rounding up is fine. Inflating is a different beast entirely. Just don't do it. It's not going to work out.
I've worked with a couple of consultants at different places that did that. And the biggest thing was is they tended to not be very good at keeping track of their lies. And so, like, you know, because, like, you know, if you're coming out of a time system, right, like the workflow for the guy that we caught at a former employer was he would pull stuff out of his time system and put it into ours. I think somebody had dumped out a report and then something happened to the record and so he had to re-enter. He didn't keep track of his fake time appropriately and so he entered a different time and, you know, got busted. And of course, you know, canned him.
But yeah, it's bad karma. It's bad ethics. It's bad business. You
it's
will
too
get
much
caught.
Too.
It will breed resentment. Yeah. Don't do it. I mean, don't. You know, yeah, if anything, So one thing I just want to say is sometimes I'll deliberately underbill my invoices. Yeah. And you know what? That's just me throwing in like a little freebie for the client. You know, it builds some good karma. It's like a nice karma card that I can pull out of my back pocket if I absolutely need to, you know, smooth some things over with the client. You can mention, well, I didn't really bill you for this, blah, 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 blah. Not to say that being a consultant is like a vampire, but a good vampire doesn't bleed their victim dry the first time they suck their blood. You know, you want to keep them, you know, milk that cow. You don't want to slaughter your golden goose.
Well, the other thing, too, about the overbilling on the hours is that it's trying to solve the problem in the wrong way. Because usually when somebody's doing that, their mindset is, I'm not getting paid enough, so I'll bill more hours.
Yeah.
And that's a backward approach. Like, bill enough and you don't have to do that. You're not in a situation where you're going to lose your house if you don't. So, like, it's the wrong solution to a deeper level problem.
What's the right solution to the deeper problem? It's not padding your hours. It's prospecting more. It's spending more time hunting for work. It's putting in the investment to write articles, to do podcasts, to host podcasts, to go to meetups, to present at meetups, to network with people on LinkedIn, to call up old clients, to send them Christmas cards or holiday cards, to do nice things for people. That's the right solution. It's a steady grind of planting seeds. I want to share that in your contracts, you can also put a penalty for clients who don't pay you, so that interest will accumulate, after the 30th day of an unpaid invoice or the 14th day of an unpaid invoice, whatever you agree on. This both rewards you for invoicing regularly, which you absolutely should do, is invoice every week, ideally. So if there's a problem with your bill, the client has an opportunity to dispute it right away. That way, if things get hairy, your lawyer can say, well, Zach sent you this invoice, then he sent you another invoice, then he sent you another invoice, and you had him work for you. If he was so dishonest, you had plenty of opportunity to review these invoices, and you neglected to do so. It sounds like you're really just trying to, you know, worm your way into a discount or something. So invoicing regularly both prevents issues that arise because of disputes and allows late payment penalties to start kicking in.
Yeah, have you also done the other thing, the other side of that, of like offering a slight discount if they pay early?
Yep, that's awesome. That's great
technique. Yeah, because that helps the cash flow a ton. Because that's the biggest thing, you know, working on your own. It sucks when somebody owes you like $15,000 and you're like, okay, how am I going to make the mortgage this month?
Exactly.
Finally, in your book, you talk about what developers need to learn when it comes to business. Are there business classes or anything out there that is for developers?
Well, I can tell you that right now, I'm working on a new e-learning course. It's like a MOOC with videos and exercises, and it'll teach you a bunch of the skills you need to know. It's for developers. I'm a developer. I talk in language that hopefully other developers can understand. You know, it's all rooted in logical analysis, and I try to explain things with, you know, in ways and metaphors that programmers will understand. If you buy the book, you get access to my Slack channel, you'll get early access to the content for free in exchange for reviewing it, or you can just, you know, stick around on my mailing list, follow my Twitter, and I'll tweet, and I'll let you know when it's available.
So, Zach, do you have any other shout-outs?
Thanks for asking. Will and Beach, thank you so much. This is my first developer podcast. I'm extremely stoked. I think it went super well, despite some unexpected fun with
other people's code.
Exactly. That wasn't invented here. Other people's code. You know, big round of applause to those brilliant seriously, it's been fun. I want to thank my co-author, Jay Alkaki. He's been great throughout this process. He was a great co-author. I want to thank my dad, Rick Burt, for contributing a bunch of legal chapters. Extremely well written. I learned a lot from you. And I want to thank all the clients over the years that have given me their business. I wouldn't have been able to share this without you. And I want to thank all the developers out here who are listening. Get the book. I'm available for you. I'm a resource. I'm here to help. If you don't like the book, you buy it from me. Write me an email with 500 words on why you don't like it, and I'll refund your money. That's a guarantee.
That's a great guarantee. Hey, we want to thank you, Zach, for coming on the show and sharing your experience with us. I read the book this past week, and guys, we barely skimmed the surface of the topics he covers. So the moment everyone has been waiting for, Zach is giving our listeners a really great deal. If you use the code COMPLETEDEV, that's all caps, COMPLETEDEV, on his website, you can purchase his book, Code for Cash, for just $5. That's an awesome deal. That pretty much closes us out, but before we finish up, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I just kind of want to reiterate, what he was saying. At the core of it, you know, consulting or contracting or even employment is the management of incentives. You kind of need to think through where the other party is coming from. Every time that you're interacting with somebody, especially people that are outside, the development realm, because they typically have, kind of a different agenda than you do, just try to internalize the idea that I want to know why this person is acting this way, not making the assumption that they're acting that way because of the reasons that you would act that way. And I just want to throw that out there, that that's something you can start paying attention to now and improve your career, even if you're not going into the private sector. Or even if you're not, going out to work for yourself. So that's all I got.
Stand by for Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.